You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōku ingoa, nō mai hare mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, it's me again, Jemima. I'm back after breakfast. It's level 4 and we're running a remote newsroom, so I will be here on the wire for as long as we're in level 4, which I'm excited about because I like presenting the awesome work that the news team does on The Wire, despite the fact that I miss them all being here with me. It's very lonely out there in the newsroom, but it's important that we all stay at home and look after each other. But anyway, you're on The Wire. This is the current affairs and news show for Wednesday, and we are keeping you up to date with the latest newsy bits, which are hugely important, in my opinion, all of the time, but particularly at the moment as we sit in level 4. I'm hosting the show today for Zazie and Francis, who have been working diligently at home in their bubbles to bring you some awesome news for the show today. E whai akine, coming up on the show, we have our regular segment, Dear Science, with Alan Blackman. This week, Francis is talking about a new analysis of a scurvy study that is leading to updates on vitamin C needs. Critics who say a childhood asthma study unethically withheld care from its participants, and a new laser-powered nuclear fusion effort which neared ignition. Zazie is talking to the Department of Microbiology and Immunology Professor Miguel Quinones-Matu about the investigation on wastewater and how it can be used to get a more accurate picture of COVID-19 cases in low to middle income countries. Then Francis is talking with Emmanuel Calafatilis about the results of a recent Research New Zealand's housing survey. And then finally, Zazie has her regular chat with ACT Party's deputy leader, Brooke Van Velden, where she speaks to Brooke about New Zealand's alert level 4 lockdown and the vaccination rollouts being paused for 48 hours due to this. He aho o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So, tukapātui mai, you can send me through a text on 5395. Wai mai rānei, give me a call in studio on 309 3879, if that's what you'd prefer to do. Also, after the show, koe e wariwari e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō he pakihiri rokiroki maranga i te pai tukutuku o Irarangi Pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Head up to the Bcasts on the right of the page, go to The Wire, and you can see what we've done for years, if you want to look back that far. You can also catch up with us on our social media, which is 95BFM News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But I thought, because it is the news of the day, I'm going to give you a little bit of a roundup on the latest COVID-19 level 4 lockdown news in New Zealand.
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
The whole of New Zealand has been in alert level 4 lockdown since 11:59 last night. This follows the news reported yesterday afternoon that a community case of COVID-19 was detected in the Auckland community. Case A is a 58-year-old man who lives in Devonport and is unvaccinated. His wife, who is fully vaccinated, has tested negative for the virus. Case A had travelled to the Coromandel, and all of the current locations of interest are in the Auckland and Coromandel area. You can head to the Ministry of Health website to check out those locations of interest there. This morning on RNZ's Morning Report, the Prime Minister announced that case A was the Delta variant. She also said that 4 other cases had been reported. This brings the current total of COVID-19 cases in the community to 5. All 5 cases are linked. Case B works with case A. The 3 other cases are connected to case B, one of those being a worker at Auckland City Hospital. All staff and patients on the ward where the hospital worker worked are isolating and being tested for COVID-19 currently. None of the 5 cases have yet been linked to MIQ or the border. Under level 4 regulations, the government requires that everyone stays at home within their bubble, unless you are an essential worker. People should be maintaining social distancing of 2 metres and get a COVID-19 test if you have cold or flu symptoms. If you are feeling unwell or showing symptoms right now, you can find your nearest testing station on the Auckland Regional Public Health Services website. Auckland and the Coromandel will be in level 4 lockdown for at least 7 days, and the rest of the country will be in level 4 for at least 3 days. An update from the Prime Minister and the Director General of Health will take place at 1 p.m. this afternoon, so just after The Wire. But anyway, let's get into the pieces that Francis and Zazie have been creating for the show today.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, Francis was joined by Alan Blackman, where they talked about scurvy and vitamin C needs, a childhood asthma study that unethically withheld care from its participants, and a laser-powered nuclear fusion effort that neared ignition. Here it is now.
Let's begin by talking about the scurvy study that's leading to updates on vitamin C needs. Tell me about that.
Yeah, no, very interesting. So I guess everyone knows about vitamin C, and that's been known since sort of Captain Cook's time, way back when he sailed around the world and he gave all his sailors lime juice. And that stopped all their teeth falling out and stuff like that, which is what happens when you get scurvy. And just a note about vitamins, seeing as we're talking about vitamins a bit today, is that they're not pronounced vitamin. It's vitamin because it came originally from two words, vital amine. So there we go. Right. So it was World War II. It was World War II Britain, and there was not a lot of food around. And so some people there decided to do a study on vitamin C in 1944 and try and figure out, right, what's the minimum amount of vitamin C that you can have that would then prevent scurvy? Because this was kind of important at the time, you know, shortage of food and especially sort of, you know, citrus fruits and stuff that contain vitamin C. So what happened was that they got 20 volunteers, and funnily enough, quite a few of them apparently were conscientious objectors to the war. I guess they were doing their bit, and they were supervised by a guy called Hans Krebs, who you may have heard of from the Krebs cycle, which is very famous in biochemistry, and he was a future Nobel laureate. And so what they did was they had a situation where they would give these volunteers different amounts of vitamin C over a 9-month period. So the volunteers either got zero or 10 milligrams or 70 milligrams a day for a period of 9 months. And obviously sort of giving zero is not really the best, because vitamin C is kind of essential. And it's particularly essential when it comes to repairing wounds. So the way that they were figuring out what that minimum amount of vitamin C was going to be was that they would wound the subject, quote unquote, and I couldn't find out what they actually did to quote unquote.
Oh, I'd love to know.
Yeah. And then what they would do was, when those wounds healed, they would test the scar strength of those wounds as some sort of measure of the minimum amount of vitamin C that was needed for those wounds to repair properly. And as a result of this, they came up with a figure of 10 milligrams per day. And partly as a result of this, then Health Organization many years later said that, okay, we think that everybody on the planet should have 45 milligrams a day of vitamin C. That's basically the minimum amount, or the recommended amount, certainly from the WHO. Now, this was a good 60, 70, getting on for 80 years ago. And so what's happened is that the researchers at the University of Washington, they've gone back and looked at this original study with the benefit now of modern statistical techniques that can be applied to very, very small sample sizes, because again, there are only 20 volunteers in this study. And what they found was that when they look at the data through a modern lens, that in fact, this has been quite massively underestimated in terms of the amount of vitamin C that everyone needs. And what they are now recommending is 95 milligrams a day, which is over double the World Health Organization's recommended amount.
Wow.
And what they also found on the basis of those data as well was that if you have been vitamin C deficient, it's not just a matter of sort of gobbling down a handful of the stuff and you're going to be fine in a couple of days. It takes at least 6 months at quite high levels of 90 milligrams a day to recover from vitamin C deficiency. And again, as I say, you know, the whole thing about vitamin C deficiency is scurvy, which is kind of nasty and obviously not something you would want. But sort of prefacing our second story, it would be very, very difficult to get ethics approval for a study like this today because of the fact that some of the participants were actually getting no vitamin C at all for 9 months.
And being mysteriously wounded in some way.
Yes, I know.
Right.
Yeah, I would love to find how they did that, but yes, another time.
Fascinating. Let's move on to the second vitamin, not vitamin story about critics who are saying a childhood asthma study unethically withheld care from its participants.
Yeah. And this, again, is very interesting. And again, it's got to do with vitamins, and in this case, vitamin D. And so, as hopefully people sort of know, one of the, byproducts of vitamin D deficiency is a thing called rickets. So sort of weak bones, and you get bow legs and stuff like that. So vitamin D is very, very important for bone health and bone growth, et cetera, et cetera. Now, some researchers in the States, they were studying asthmatic children, and they thought that there might be perhaps some beneficial effect of vitamin D on asthma. And so they applied for money to do a big study on this to see whether there would be any benefit of supplementing children who are deficient in vitamin D with vitamin D, these asthmatic children. And so in 2016, they got $4.3 million to carry out this study. And these were people at the University of Pittsburgh. So the plan was that they were going to get 400 kids. And the participants would be or would have low vitamin D levels, or they'd be actually deficient in vitamin D, which is, you know, even worse than being low. So in the end, they only got around about half of that number of participants. And again, the plan was that half of the participants would be given vitamin D supplements, so quite high levels of vitamin D. And the controversial bit was that the other half of the participants would be given just a placebo. So they wouldn't be given any vitamin D, basically. No vitamin D supplementation. And that's where the problem came, because, okay, so children who have asthma quite often are treated with steroids. And steroids have a deleterious effect on bones, or certainly can do anyway. So they can weaken bones. And so coupled with the fact that these children are vitamin D deficient anyway, or at least some of them were, then what that would pretty obviously lead to is very much greater risk of bone fractures.
Yeah.
Now, the study's authors did not put this in the consent form, that the children were expected to be at greater risk of bone fractures. And so the study went ahead, but in fact it was called off well before its due finishing date, and this was in 2019, and it was called off for quote-unquote futility, which basically says that there was no positive effect of vitamin D supplementation on the severity of asthma attacks of these children. Now, weirdly, what then happened after it was called off was that some of the children who were participating were kept on a placebo for 6 months after the study was actually called off. And again, remember, these, or some of them at least, were children who were very deficient in vitamin D. So they ended up publishing the study last year in 2020 in the Journal of the American Medical Association. So it's a pretty good journal. In that study, they didn't disclose the fact that 9 children actually ended up with broken bones during the study. And that was about double what would be statistically expected. And so, what has now happened is that the journal Science, so this is a very, very top journal in science, hence the name, and they have gone and sort of got all the documents related to the study, and they have now gone through this pretty much with a fine-tooth comb, and they're really saying that, wow, this should not have been done in the first instance. It just really didn't satisfy what would be now thought of as appropriate ethical guidelines. And so around about a third of the children who were involved in the study really had hazardously low vitamin D levels. And, you know, by just giving them a placebo, you know, they were really sort of endangering them and making them, you know, much, much more susceptible to problems with bones and stuff. And so the question, the big ethical question then becomes, you know, can you give participants in a study like this no care? You know, because obviously some of the kids are getting vitamin D supplements, but others who the study's authors knew were dangerously low in vitamin D, they were getting absolutely no supplements. And the study's authors kind of said, well, this wasn't a problem because if we hadn't tested them for their vitamin D levels, then we'd never have known that they were low in vitamin D anyway, which
but,
doesn't
yeah, really... but then where's the sort of moral conscience? And once you know that, you therefore, yes, yeah, tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. Tricky. So this is a really, really quite big article in the latest version of, or in the latest edition of Science magazine. So it's, you know, it's probably worth a read if any of you out there listening are interested in this sort of stuff. It really does go into big detail about this, and also other studies as well, where similar sorts of things has happened, you know, where they're looking for treatment versus a placebo in situations where, you know, morally probably a placebo shouldn't have been used.
Right. Okay, and finally, let's talk about what some are calling an explosive new result. Excuse the pun.
Very good.
Which I stole off the webpage. But this new laser-powered nuclear fusion effort, which neared ignition. This is very exciting. Tell me about that.
It is indeed. Okay, so as we know, we're running out of fossil fuels. We need a new source of energy. My bet is on the sun, but other people are saying that nuclear fusion is the way to go. The sun's probably a lot easier, but nuclear fusion is the process that actually powers our sun, so it's kind of the same thing. And as you might expect, for a process that powers our sun, you need very, very, very high temperatures and very, very, very high pressures, because what you're doing is basically squeezing two atomic nuclei together to create a new nucleus, and that process occurs with a massive, massive amount of energy. Okay, so puts out a huge amount of energy, and that's what goes on in a hydrogen bomb, for example, as opposed to a nuclear bomb. So what humanity really wants to do is to tame this process and be able to carry it out under controlled conditions. And if we can do that, then we really have got a limitless energy supply. So obviously a bit of money was being put into this, and at a place called the National Ignition Facility, and this is in the USA, and it is an outpost of the Lawrence Livermore Lab, which is a very, very famous scientific lab in the States. And what they do is that they've got a massive, massive laser there, and they split this into 192 separate beams. And then each of these beams, they focus on a tiny, tiny target of tritium and deuterium. And these are isotopes of hydrogen, same atomic number, different atomic mass, as all my first years would tell me, hopefully. And they are contained, or this target of tritium and deuterium are contained in a tiny pellet of gold. And so these lasers are then focused on this tiny pellet of gold over a very, very, very short time period. So they get a massive amount of energy over about 20 nanoseconds. And what this does, it vaporizes the gold, and this forms X-rays, and these X-rays then basically implode, as rather than explode, but they implode the target onto itself, and that creates really, really high pressures and really, really high temperatures, and then you get some fusion happening there. So that's basically the guts of the process. So wow. It's difficult. It's not easy, But the big thing is that last week, what these workers managed to do was to get out 70% of the energy that they put in, and they based on the basis of this laser pulse, this very, very short laser pulse. And up until that time, what they had been getting was around about 3%.
So, yeah.
So 70% is a massive, massive, massive jump. And then theoretically, obviously, what they can do is to get over 100%. That's the whole point of this, is to get enough fusion events happening so that the energy that they get out of this is more than the energy that they put into it. So I guess that's the trouble with fusion, is that, you know, the gear that you need to actually get this going is just, you know, massively, massively expensive. But gosh, if it works, then the payback is just going to be absolutely phenomenal, and we will basically have our energy problems sorted. And, you know, those of you who are in the central North Island who had the big power cuts, you know, a couple of days ago, and then they were sort of threatening one again last night on top of this bloody COVID thing, you know, they were short of electricity again. So, you know, hopefully not too far in the distant future, all of these problems might be a distant memory.
Yeah. Well, all fingers crossed. Hey, thanks so much, Alan, for chatting with me. Hopefully we'll see you in the studio in 2 weeks.
Amen to that. Yes, please. Fingers crossed.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Amen to that. That was Alan Blackman speaking to Francis on this week's Dear Science. Also, in regards to vitamin, I was probably saying vitamin because I think I do most of the time. He aho whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tukupatui mai, you can send me through a text on 5395 or give me a call in studio on 309 3879. It's a good thing to do while we have a little break. So here is one.
Southbound Records, New Zealand's large range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need. Brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more. Their in-store experts can help you out whatever genre you're into. So support your local and head into Southbound today. Southbound Records, your vinyl specialists. Pop in at 132 Simon Street or order online.
Prowl for your new friendly local? Look no further than Scarecrow, the cafe with great food and groceries, plentiful vegan fare also, alongside a great buzz. Right beside Albert Park, Scarecrow is located at 33 Victoria Street East. Explore their range of food, which is rated amongst the best in town by Heart of the City. Browse their gifts, local flowers, organic teas and coffees. You can also find them at 811 Mount Eden Road. To learn more, call them on 09 377 1333 or shop online for Auckland-wide delivery at scarecrow.co.nz.
Oh, what a beautiful moment. The sun setting all purple and gold. Oh.
You can still see where your dad hired a plane to skywrite. Actually, I am proud of you.
Yeah. I wish I had somewhere to capture this memory. Just, you know, a static image to immortalise this moment.
Look, 1,000 butterflies.
Take a picture. It'll last longer. And whatever your level, you'll take better ones with Pro Gear. 100% camera, 0% bullshit. Pro Gear, 3 Railway Street, Newmarket. Or go to progear.co.nz.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Moulds. Thank you.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima, and I'm hosting the Wednesday Wire today for Zazie and Francis because we're in level 4 lockdown. In COVID news, just briefly, RNZ is reporting that there are large lines at testing centres in the North Island. Also, that early this morning, a large party was broken up in the early hours of the morning in Dunedin, which was in breach of lockdown. Anyway, getting in to the next piece. Professor Miguel Quinones Mateo of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Otago is part of an international team investigating how wastewater can be used to get a more accurate picture of COVID-19 cases in low to middle income countries. Led by Otago and Western University, Canada, the project involves researchers in Uganda, Ghana, Colombia, Venezuela, and Fiji. They are trying to gain an understanding of infection in the populations and look for emerging variants of concern. Zazi began speaking to Professor Quinones Mateo to talk about the investigation in more detail.
So, as you know, of course, we're in the middle of this pandemic, but people have been using this technology, the ability to try to detect the virus in wastewater or sewage for the last, I would say, almost a year now, 10 months or something like that. Even here in New Zealand, we use it, ESR, been using it for a while now, just a way to surveillance and just to keep check of what's going on in the community. In fact, some of these cases that we have now, even on the, yesterday, I think that they have been trying to be detected, you know, using these, you know, wastewater and sewage. So anyway, all that good is being used in all these countries in Europe and Canada and the US, all that. But to my knowledge, not that many people have been trying to use these in low to middle income countries, where, I mean, where we must, it's most needed, of course. That the way that we're doing all these surveillance is just try to swap and test as many people as possible. But that's not pleasant, to be honest. And the other thing is that the most important thing is that most people that get tested is because they have some symptoms somehow. Okay. So there is a lot of people asymptomatic out there, you know, more than 70% of the people that get these virus are asymptomatic, that they don't, you know, they don't get tested, or they, because they don't want, or they don't have to, or whatever. But they could be spreading the virus. And the only way to be detecting those is just to do this indirect sampling, which is using wastewater. You may know that this virus, of course, is infecting the upper and lower respiratory tract, but there have been many, many, many publications and findings that you can actually find that the virus in the feces, okay? It's not replication competent, so you're not gonna get infected with the virus, but you have, you know, fragments of the RNA, of the genetic material of the virus there. So by testing those wastewater samples, you should be able to detect what's happening in the community. So let's say that here in Dunedin, north of Dunedin, if we have 1,000 people infected, I mean, everybody has to go eventually to the bathroom and everything. So that would be detected in the wastewater, okay? So that's been done and all the protocols, everything has been set up. So we decided, we put this together maybe 6 months ago. We started talking with my colleagues in Canada and the US to do these, like I say, low to middle income countries. So I've been working with Professor Eric Arts from the Western University in London, Ontario, in Canada, for more than 20-something years. We have been working on HIV in Africa, different places. So we decided to try to adapt all this expertise that we have now to these wastewater, you know, surveillance project. So we were able to contact, you know, multiple people around the world. So what we're doing is we have a multinational, international team. So we have people in Canada and the US, like I said. We have a team in Kampala and Uganda. We have a team in Ghana. I'm originally from Venezuela, so the situation in Venezuela is not good with COVID. So we have a team in Caracas in Venezuela doing this project, and a team in Medellin in Colombia doing these as well. And then I decided that we needed some kind of negative control, because of course we're going to be able to detect all these viruses in the sewage and all these places, because there's a lot of virus circulated in those countries and those regions. But it would be nice to have a negative control. So initially I thought about doing it here in New Zealand, because we don't have, of course, up to yesterday, any community cases. But then I thought about Fiji. I mean, we have some projects going on in Fiji right now related to HIV/AIDS and all this stuff. So I said, okay, maybe we could do it in Fiji since we don't have any cases in Fiji. Of course, this is 6 months ago before the outbreak and the problem that we have in Fiji now. So we started setting up everything there. And then in the meantime, this happened. And now instead of being a negative control, we became another place that we could do that. And the goal with all these is just to keep track of what's happening in the community, okay? Even before this person that could have or no symptoms got to the doctor and do the swab, you should be able to detect what's happening in the community by doing this wastewater, especially in countries, like I said, that they don't have the, you know, the capability to do it. So another thing that is really key for us is, because we have been doing this for many, many years now, is training and building capacity. So all these protocols, all these, you know, technology, you know, reagents and so on is being transferred to all these places. So in Caracas, like I said, Medellin, Ghana, Uganda, and Fiji, everybody will have the same protocol, the same SOPs. So once we're done with this study, they should be able to continue doing it and, you know, contribute it to public health in their respective countries.
Well, so how, I feel like you went into already a little bit, but how does that work? How is this investigation conducted, if you can talk about it briefly?
So what we decided was to do almost like a, I wouldn't call it a pilot study, but it's almost, just to be sure that everything is working, because like I said, we know that we can do it here in New Zealand and Canada and all the places, but just to be sure that the whole process can work on all the different, you know, sites. So what the way that we decided these was to do, collect the same number of samples, pretty much the same protocol in all the places. So what we're doing is collecting each one of these places in Caracas, Kampala, you know, Suva, and Fiji, and we're collecting in three different, you know, regions, or three different places and locations within the city, three times a week. So typically we're doing Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, just to try to capture the whole, you know, the week, four consecutive weeks. So it's basically 1 month of monitoring what's happening in the community and three different places. And so how does that work? Somebody, I mean, some member of the team, have to go to there and collect water. Pretty much, it's just sewage water in different places. So depending on the region, depending on the country, sometimes we do it in water plant, water treatment plants, okay? Sometimes it's just streams coming from, you know, favelas or all these areas that you don't have the proper sewage or system. That's what we do. So typically we collect, I don't know, anything between 100 to 500 ml, milliliters of half a liter of sewage. So, but that sewage contains not only water, but a little bit of debris, of course, and some solids as well. So that's taken to the lab, and each site and each laboratory in each place, they process that sample. So basically they go through a process of filtering and cleaning and all that. And then eventually they have a material that they're going to be able to extract RNA of the genetic material of the virus, okay? And then we will do PCR. And we will use exactly the same primer, same protocol, say everything for everyone, and see if we can detect, you know, the virus in those different places of different samples and how much we detect. I mean, during the week it goes up or down, or during the month it goes up or down, and so on. And try to correlate that with other metrics that could be happening in you know, public health metrics in the country or in the region. One thing that I didn't mention at the beginning, that of course we're focusing on, you know, like I say, building capacity and training everything for surveillance of SARS-CoV-2 in sewage and wastewater plants. But another thing that we're doing, because we can, we're virologists, and that's what we do, we're doing what we call using a metagenomic approach to see what other viruses are in those samples as well, okay? So you can just get the same sample that I mentioned before, the same RNA, and they just basically sequence everything that is there. Not only, you're not looking only for that SARS-CoV-2, but sequence any virus that could be in that sample. So we should be able to detect endemic virus, rotaviruses, hepatitis virus, who knows, whatever is circulated. And I'll try to correlate that between Africa, Latin America, North America, and now here in Fiji. So it will open the door, I mean, depending on the finding, depending on the results, to, you know, further the studies and see what we can do next. Other than, it's, you know, establishing the protocol so everybody can continue doing the surveillance, just like we're doing here in New Zealand, we're doing in other places.
Yeah, and why is it significant to be able to track COVID-19 through wastewater in, like you say, more low to middle income countries?
Well, look at what's happening around yesterday here, and pretty much overseas across the world. We need to not only monitor number of cases, but the variants as well. As you know, this Delta variant is really, really transmissible. You are not going to be able to catch up and be on top of the, you know, the epidemic of the pandemic if you're just waiting for people to go and get swabs in hospital and clinical system, okay? So we are respected because we're going to be able to PCR amplify and sequence those the variants. We should be able to say, okay, in Uganda, the virus that is circulating is you know, variant alpha, beta, or gamma, whatever it is. But in Venezuela, it's mostly delta and so on. And because we're doing longitudinal samples, we should see you know, evolution. Okay, now the epidemic is being controlled by these variants versus the other variants. So all that is being done. Like I said, with swabs, samples, all that is being done in industrialized countries, but it's now being done in low to medium income countries, and it's now being done at the level of wastewater where we can just detect not only symptomatic but asymptomatic cases again. Because those are the ones that are basically, you know, causing the problem that we have. It's not the people that, just like me today, that I'm feeling a little bit under the weather. Of course, it's not COVID, it's another virus. But when somebody has these symptoms, you go get tested and it's negative or positive or whatever. But what about the 70% of people that are out there just walking in the streets and going to bars and restaurants without symptoms and transmitting the virus? You are not going to be able to monitor those or to surveillance those unless you do these indirect surveillance to wastewater. Okay. And that's critical in the other countries, I mean, in low to medium income countries, where many people, in many cases, are afraid of the government, are afraid of doctors. They don't believe in that. They don't trust them. They don't want to go. So that's an indirect way to keep track of them and do a public health work.
And how many places around the world ordinarily do or undertake wastewater analysis or water testing protocols? Is this something new that's recently happened? Or
No. Like I said, people have been doing it for a while now. And I bet, I mean, for the last 18 months or almost 2 years now, everything that you can imagine has been done with this SARS-CoV-2. It has been amazing. Scientifically, I haven't seen it in my 20-something, 25 years as a biologist. The closest thing that I've seen something like this is with HIV/AIDS. In the 80s and the 90s, everybody started working on the early 2000s as well. Everybody started working with HIV/AIDS, and there was a huge effort.
That was Professor Miguel Quinones Mateo from the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Otago, talking about the investigation on wastewater and how it can be used to get a more accurate picture of COVID-19 cases in low to middle income countries. Unfortunately, I had to cut that one a little bit short because Zazi and Francis have done amazingly and we are running over time. So if you're interested in hearing the rest of that piece, there's still sort of 3 minutes of it to go, head to the BCast page on the 95BFM website and you can check it out there after the show.
Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Last week, Research New Zealand released the results of a survey about the state of New Zealand homes. It asked respondents whether they owned or rented their home and to rate their home on several decent home factors. This morning, Francis spoke with Emmanuel Kalafatilis, Research New Zealand's managing partner, about the results of the survey and the clear social division it shows.
Can you begin by explaining what you asked respondents to answer in your recent survey?
Listeners may know that on the 1st of August, Chief Human Rights Commissioner Paul Hunt said New Zealand governments have signed up to a critically important human right, the right to a decent home. For generations, they have promised to create the conditions to enable everyone to live in a decent home, but this has not happened. Successive governments have failed New Zealanders. So against that background, we decided to ask New Zealanders to rate their current homes, owned or rented, on a series of what we call decent home factors. We actually asked two questions. Obviously, what we had to do was establish whether people owned their own homes, either outright or with a mortgage, or they rented a home. And then having established that, we asked them to rate their homes in terms of these decent home factors, which we defined as warmth, dampness, general repair, size, amenities, and affordability.
And what were some of the standout results of your poll?
Well, I think I'd like to begin by saying that listeners may not be surprised to hear that there were significant differences in opinions between renters and those who own their own home. That's really the standout result, but listeners shouldn't be surprised because there's been a lot said about that in the recent past. The other standout for me is the result for the affordability of homes. Even amongst homeowners, and quite a few of them, of course, are owning their homes with a mortgage, just three quarters of them said that their home was affordable. So that obviously means that around one in every four are saying to us that they're not affordable. Now, that result gets even worse when you look at renters. Less than one half, 48% to be precise, of renters said that the home they live in was not affordable. So in other words, the rent that they paid was negative. No, that's not quite right. But just for your listeners' benefit, the definition of affordability that we use was the official one, which means that you're spending less than 30% of your income on renting. So coming back to our renters, less than half of them said that their rent, if you like, was good in that regard.
And were you surprised by any of the results at all?
I was surprised by the affordability result, which I've just told you about.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of other results that I wasn't surprised about, but are worth noting.
Mm-hmm.
And they relate to how warm homes are in winter and also whether they're free from damp and moisture. So if we look at the first one, how warm they are in winter, 81% of our respondents who own their own homes said that their home was warm in winter. So again, that means 20%. One in five are saying that they're not warm in winter. And continuing the pattern that we've already talked about, the situation became worse when we looked at renters. Only 61% of them said that their home was warm in winter. And given that situation, when you look at whether they're free from damp and moisture, 80% of homeowners said that their home was good in that respect, but only 60% of renters said that.
And can you tell me about sort of the social division that you found in the survey between younger and older respondents and their sort of relationship with renting and homeowning?
Absolutely. So as we know, and this isn't exclusively the case, because there are other groups in the population who are renters, but we know that most renters are young people. And by young, we mean under 35. And in contrast, homeowners tend to be people older than that. So we've got quite a divide happening in terms of age, and we probably, because of that, also got a bit of a divide happening in terms of socioeconomic status and possibly also ethnicity. In other words, those people who are renters are more likely to be younger people, have a lower socioeconomic status, and are probably more likely to be people who have a certain ethnicity. And I'm talking now about people who are Maori and Pacifica in particular.
Okay. And finally, can I ask what the significance of your survey is for steps going forward in New Zealand's response to the housing crisis?
I don't think there's a silver bullet here. This is not an issue that can be resolved in a year, 5 years, possibly even 10 years. Unless something really drastic happens. But the other thing I'd like to say is that you've got to consider the consequences of this. If you're living in a home that's not warm or is damp in winter in particular, then that obviously creates health or problems not only for the homeowners, but for their children. If you have a health problem, you're unable to work, obviously not able to earn an income and put food on the table. And so there's a bit of a circular thing happening here, isn't there?
Mm.
And I think that, aside from the need to actually resolve this problem, there are also other problems related to this.
That was Emmanuel Kalafatelis from Research New Zealand. He is the managing director, speaking with Francis about the group's recent poll on the housing crisis. You're on The Wire with Jemima on 95BFM. He aho o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of today's pieces, and I'm sure Francis and Zazi would as well. So tukapātui mai, you can send me through a text on 5395 or give me a call. 309 3879 is the number. We'll be right back after this.
Not all bread is created equal. In fact, some bread is pretty shit.
You might as well be spreading your Marmite on a chocolate bar.
Bread and Butter's sourdough is real bread, using ancient techniques and organic and regeneratively grown ingredients. Choose substance over speed. Choose age and beauty. Check out their online delivery options or head in store for brunch, great coffee and more homemade pastries than you can shake a baguette at.
Bread and Butter, the best sourdough in town.
Breadandbutter.nz.
Oh, hello, kind Kiwis. Here's your chance to volunteer during the day here to help people at night on the other side of the world. Shout 85258 is the UK's only free 24/7 mental health text support service. They're looking for New Zealand volunteers to be an essential lifeline for people who are struggling to cope. You'll get 25 hours of free mental health communication training so you can help others while developing skills for your life and studies. Apply today. Go to giveusashout.org/New Zealand.
Crossing now to our snow reporter on the ground in Wanaka. How are the conditions down there, mate?
It's a little like sand, but when you try to hold it in your hand for too long, it melts away like a memory.
And how's that for skiing?
Skiing? I won't be doing any of that tonight, Jemima. I'll be listening to the wind and cherishing every fragile moment.
All good, Doug. Cheers for that.
The 95BFM Snow Report, giving you the Powder Run Rundown from on the ground in Wanaka, 5:30 every Tuesday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. The 95BFM Snow Report, brought to you by Cadrona and Troublecomb.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden. Yes, it is that time again. Last night, as we have already mentioned a number of times this morning, all of New Zealand entered an Alert Level 4 lockdown due to one community case that has now been confirmed to have the Delta variant. New Zealand is now being told to stay in their bubbles, stay safe, and to act as though they already have COVID-19 to reduce the spread of the virus. As well as this, Jacinda Ardern announced last night that all vaccinations will be paused for 48 hours to allow them to be undertaken safely. So today, Zazi spoke to ACT Party's Deputy Leader, Brooke Van Velden, to hear her thoughts on New Zealand's Alert Level 4 lockdown, as well as talk to her about the vaccinations being paused for 48 hours.
Is it an overreaction to go into Level 4 lockdown?
Look, I think it's disappointing that we're needing to go into another lockdown, and that will be coming as a shock to a lot of people who were hearing the news yesterday and scrambling to find new arrangements for their family situation, especially if they're essential workers who are still going out onto that front line and working for us and helping to keep us safe, but needing to find arrangements for their family members and their children who can't go to school. But there are also a lot of businesses who I know will also be struggling. You know, people, if you look down here, an example is Wellington on a Plate. People who have forked out thousands of dollars of supplies for the next month who will be very anxious about what that means for them going forward. But ultimately, I think locking down was the right thing to do because it appears that's the only tool that we have in the toolkit at the moment to make sure that we don't have community spread throughout the country. But the ACT Party will be here making sure that we are having constructive criticism where necessary and providing alternatives and asking the questions that the government does need to be held accountable for. Because I know many New Zealanders will have questions, especially when it comes to how is it that we're in the same situation of 18 months ago? Have we gone back to exactly the same starting point, or has the government actually been doing things to make sure that we can get out of a lockdown earlier and faster and make sure that this doesn't happen again and again and again?
Going back to your comment about it being the only tool that we have, do you think that New Zealand's elimination strategy of going hard and early is the correct strategy to use, or would you advocate something different?
I think it's the tool that we have in the toolkit for now, because the government has been so slow at rolling out the vaccine, and I wouldn't even consider it a vaccine rollout. It's more a vaccine strollout. And we know from overseas evidence coming through that the more people that are vaccinated in a population, the less likely transmission is to occur. And we know that we are the lowest in the OECD for our vaccination rollout. And one of the questions that's on our mind is, how is it that the government has not been prepared enough for another lockdown to make sure that we can also keep vaccinating at the same time? Now, when the government came out with its lockdown announcement yesterday, the Prime Minister said that we were going to pause vaccinations for 48 hours. Vaccinations, we know, have to roll out. People want to know that they can protect themselves and protect their families and protect vulnerable people in the community. How is it that there has not been enough of a contingency plan in place to make sure that we can not only be in this lockdown, but be preparing for the fact that we don't need to continue being in another lockdown by making sure that we continue with our vaccinations?
So the vaccinations have only been paused for 48 hours. Did you expect the vaccinations to continue as normal after the announcement of level 4?
I would absolutely have expected there to be a plan in place for vaccinations to roll out as an essential service, because if you look at it from this perspective, we're still able to go and get our essential goods from supermarkets. The essential hospitals are still open for people who really, really desperately need it. Vaccinations are an essential service. It's how we prepare and keep staying on top of COVID in our community. The idea that it's more dangerous to go and get vaccinated than it is to be in a crowded place getting your supermarket and grocery goods is absurd, and it cannot be that the government has not been prepared enough to know that if there is another lockdown, we need vaccinations to continue. So how is it possible that a supermarket manages to stay open as an essential service? I see they're already open, operating today. People are going out getting the goods that they need. But we cannot have people going to get an essential vaccination.
So what could have been done, in your opinion, to ensure that vaccinations continued rather than being paused for 48 hours?
Yeah, well, it seems absolutely nonsensical to me that we could be in a situation where supermarkets, which are considered an essential service, are able to be up and operational, running so people can get the goods that they need now at the beginning of a lockdown, when vaccinations, which are a way of preparing and keeping us safe in our community and keeping people who are vulnerable safe, has to be paused in order to become useful again in 48 hours. There should have been a plan in place to make sure that as little time as possible was lost to continue with the rollout of vaccinations, because I don't want us to be in an ongoing situation where people are having their vaccines cancelled and not being able to rebook those because of a lockdown. And to be fair, we don't actually know how long this lockdown may go for. So for us to pause vaccinations during a lockdown, I think, is just nonsensical.
So what type of preparations or plans could the government have made in the timeframe?
Well, the government does have plans in place or had advice on what to do at level 4 when it had a vaccine rollout. And it could, for example, do the same thing it does for COVID testing, where you have a drive-in service. I do not see why it could be so hard for us to have a contingency plan when we know that this could have been likely to happen. The government's response needs to be better, but these are the questions that we need to be asking on behalf of all New Zealanders who don't want to have to be going into lockdowns.
Just moving back to the lockdown itself, how likely do you think it is that this lockdown will be 3 to 7 days?
Oh, look, I don't think we really can know at this point how long this lockdown will go for. For now, we know that all of New Zealand will be locked down for 3 days and Auckland and the Coromandel for 7 days. But these are the questions that we need to be asking of the government. Have they been doing any work to make sure that we've been more prepared for another lockdown? Or are we in a very similar situation that we were in 18 months ago when we were getting our head around going into a lockdown? Has there been any more work done on community tracking and tracing? Has there been any more information that the government has that it's not been made transparent? Because we know from previous lockdowns that the government hasn't been as open and transparent and efficient as it could be in letting the public know what's happening, but it also hasn't been as open about its failures with its contact tracing system. And I think New Zealanders need to know what the government has been doing in the background to prepare us for this new lockdown and community tracing. Or have they been sitting on their hands and we're in the exact same situation that we were in months ago?
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the Wednesday Wire for another week. Huge shout out to everyone who spoke with us for the show today, and thank you very much to all of you for tuning in, sending in your text and giving me a call. Always love hearing from you, particularly in this lockdown scenario. I also want to say a huge shout out to Zazie and Francis. That was their first ever lockdown creation show, so really, really impressed with how they managed to pull it together. It's awesome. So thank you so much, Zazie and Francis. I also want to say a massive thank you to 95BFM's large volunteer newsroom, who are working diligently from home during this lockdown to bring you 8 news bulletins and an hour-long current affairs show a day. They're doing amazingly already, and as always, I'm just so proud with how quickly the news team adapts and how committed they are to bringing you quality journalism here at 95BFM. We will catch you next time on The Wire. I'll see you tomorrow on The Wire, and I'll see you on breakfast as well. Stay safe out there, wash your hands, wear your masks, and stay home. Up next is Bridge with the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.